Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, which means it is our week in review, and we were kind of thinking the weather this week sums it up. Glimpses of sun amidst the storms. City of Boston shines new light on how the police handled charges against former officer and union head Patrick Rose.
Swift action should have been taken. It is shameful that the actions taken were to protect one of their own rather than to protect children.
And in Washington, some sunlight on a path forward, perhaps on the aftermath of January 6th, and on bipartisan infrastructure.
We are trying to build an infrastructure package that works for all of our states, that works for all of our people.
But storm clouds overhead for COVID, with shocking new data on how infectious Delta is leading the DC. And that's leading the CDC to change course. Here's Rochelle Walensky.
In areas with substantial and high transmission, CDC recommends fully vaccinated people wear masks in public indoor settings. This includes schools.
While Governor Charlie Baker tries to read how bad the storm's going to be, issues new school guidance, but holds off on statewide masking rules. And he says a solid vaccine strategy is the best way out.
I mean, I hear from people all the time who say to me, I'd really like to see that thing get final approval. And I don't blame them. I would, too. I think it would make a really big difference.
We will pick it up there on COVID, breakthrough cases, Provincetown, new masking. Our analysts this week, former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, now the president and executive director of Learn Launch. Governor Jane Swift, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you. And we have a new analyst this week, Gary Daffin. He is the executive director of the Multicultural AIDS Coalition and the co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Gary, we've had you on the show before, but welcome to your first Week in Review. And maybe we don't have Gary for his first Week in Review. It has been one of those weeks, folks. Gary, are you there? All right, so Governor Swift, it is you and me until I am sure we have Gary, but fortunately, we're going to have some listeners too. Gary, there you are. Hey, you good to go?
I'm good to go.
That is live radio, folks. I mess up on the intro and then we don't have Gary. But now we are ready for a full week in review. And I want to put the ask out to listeners because I want to ask you, are we in limbo or are you clear about where we stand in Massachusetts, what should happen, what the guidelines are, et cetera? And we'll give you a little bit more about that. But are you okay with getting more information as we figure it out? Or do you wish we had more clarity now? Is it better to overshoot on restrictions so we know what we're doing or really follow the science and keep adjusting a little bit at a time as we go along? I'd like to know what you think. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Okay, so Jane, Gary, I'm going to start with what we've just heard from the governor in the last hour or so. He basically said that he encourages mask wearing for people who are vaccinated if they are specifically or particularly vulnerable to illness, to getting COVID, or if they are around others who might be. That's a little different than the CDC. And he expressed some frustration with the state of play from the CDC. It's been a while since we've heard that kind of, I think, frustration with the administration and with Washington. What's your reaction, Jane?
So I definitely understand the frustration. And I will say, so I'm one of those people who's back to masks because I live with an immunocompromised person. You know, the science is evolving because the virus is new. I do think that it would be helpful, as the governor stated, to get final approval of the vaccine. And I think that's where most of his frustration was coming from.
So, Gary, I'm going to play you a little more sound from the governor. He was speaking this afternoon in Roxbury, expressing frustration also on the vaccine's lack of official FDA approval. Here he is.
I am one of many governors, Democrats and Republicans, who believe when you get to the point where you've delivered 400 million shots of vaccine and have the kind of results that these vaccines have demonstrated, and you are concerned, as we are, about the Delta variant, where's the urgency at the federal level on this one? Where is it?
So interesting, Gary, because the conversation this week seems to really have been masks, right? And here is the governor saying, nuh-uh, it is still vaccines.
Well, I think that, you know, people are understandably confused. But I think that what we know is that this new variant is much more virulent and much more easily transmitted. And so in a way, the game has changed a bit. So I think we should, you know, rethink the guidelines that we've had, because it's not the same virus. And I do understand that people don't want to go back to wearing masks. But, you know, I too was with my mother this weekend, and I was wearing a mask, and so was she. And, you know, I don't think that the FDA approval is really that important. We know that the vaccine works. There's enough science to tell us that the vaccine works. And I think saying that we're waiting for the official approval, to me, I hear that from some of the people who are really not supporting the vaccine. So I wish the governor wouldn't be saying that. I think people need to focus on getting people vaccinated, but people need to understand that even if you are vaccinated, the viral load can be high enough that you can transmit it to other people who are not vaccinated. And so we do have to go back to a public health strategy where, even though we, you know, all of us have done everything right, we have to go back to protecting other people as well. And so I don't really think that, you know, focusing on the FDA is the right strategy.
I want to grab a call here, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Steve on the line in Boston. Steve, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have possibly a two-dimensional question. I'll try to keep it really, really brief. First of all, I, like everybody else of good conscience, was, you know, kind of upset at the frequent comparisons of COVID to the flu early in the pandemic. But now I'm wondering if it's a more apt comparison, because we know how to treat it. You know, like any disease, it does tragically result in some deaths. And I want to know if we have updated numbers comparing it to the flu in terms of outcomes. And also, on the subject of vaccines, I got the vaccine as soon as I possibly could, and I think it's the responsible thing to do that. And I'm wondering at what point we say, if a person hasn't gotten vaccinated, then they've just decided to adopt that risk themselves. And so, you know, we're not going to stop all of society, force everybody to wear masks, force everybody to social distance, shut down businesses, et cetera, because a small set of people has decided that they will undergo, they'll, you know, take some risk themselves. At
okay.
What point do we...
Let me take it back from you there, Steve. So there's a lot there. On Steve's question about the coronavirus and the flu, let's turf that one, actually, till next Tuesday when we do Ask the Doctors. That is a perfect Ask the Doctors question. We do them every Tuesday. We will make a note of it, Steve, and we'll see if we can get that in front of our doctors next Tuesday. Now, Jane, I'm going to turn back to you. You noted yourself just a minute ago that you have an immunocompromised spouse. We also know that right now children under the age of 12 can't be vaccinated. We also are hearing increasing frustration from those who are vaccinated towards those who can be and choose not to be. So what's your reaction to what Steve just had to say?
So I think, first of all, when he talks about closing down businesses, I don't think anyone is talking about that right now. So I think we want to say that that is not what is on the table at the moment. And that's what we're all trying. And I think we're going to be able to avoid. And the best way to do that, and I think Gary and I agree, which is awesome for his first time doing this show with me, which is, you know, vaccines work. They may not prevent you now from transmitting in some cases the Delta variant, but they definitely bring down the severity if you should get the disease. And I think the question is, when should you vaccine plus mask? And so I just think that is where the public health debate is right now. Vaccines, I think universally, all reasonable people think those who can get vaccinated should. For those who choose not to, I think the problem is, if there are enough of those people, and, you know, that's, I think, the governor's frustration and mine with final FDA approval, is if that convinced another 5%, herd immunity protects those 12-year-olds and younger. Herd immunity, the more people who are vaccinated, the lower the transmission, so that those who are at risk, like my husband, who are severely immune compromised, who had a kidney transplant, those individuals, the more people who can be vaccinated, who have been vaccinated, who do get vaccinated, the safer those who are at risk.
So I'm going to pull out a couple of pieces of sound here, because, Gary, I want to dig into something that I think is hard and confusing for people. So bear with me here. This is the CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, formerly of MGH, this week announcing the new masking guidelines and the science behind them.
Information on the Delta variant from several states and other countries indicates that in rare occasions, some vaccinated people infected with the Delta variant after vaccination may be contagious and spread the virus to others.
So we now know that some of the information that led the CDC to that conclusion actually came from the outbreak in Provincetown. So here is town manager of Provincetown, Alex Morris. He was on with us, I think, just last week. But here he is on CNN this morning. And he noted that of all the cases in Provincetown, there hasn't been a single death and very few hospitalizations, but also this.
74% of the overall cases are among fully vaccinated individuals. And I think that came as a surprise to many folks that, you know, we were told that if you're vaccinated, you're almost invincible. And I think many people wrongly assume that. And so what's been interesting, and I think the silver lining here, is that the vaccine is clearly working.
Okay, so Gary, on the one hand, we hear more and more about breakthrough cases. We hear about the increased threat from Delta. We hear that the viral load is 1,000 times more than with the previous COVID strain. We hear that it's more likely that you will spread it if you're vaccinated but still have it than the previous COVID strain. But on the other hand, we also know fewer deaths, less serious illness. The vaccines are still proving effective on those fronts. What do we expect people to do other than be frustrated and confused?
I think people are very confused and more frustrated than confused, because particularly people who've done everything right, have masked for a year, and now are being told, and we're told that if you take a vaccine, then you can do whatever, and now you have to go back to wearing masks. But again, we have to go back to, you know, what's in the best interest of the public health. And yes, people, we can't force people to take a vaccine, but we can sanction people if they don't. And so businesses and I think schools and other places have the right to say you cannot come here unless you're going to wear a mask. Now, how we communicate, and this is, I think, a problem with this, that the CDC has had because it's happened so fast, is communicating why it is that, you know, it's a good thing to get a vaccine and you still have to wear a mask. And I think fundamentally the issue is, if you take a vaccine, you won't get sick, but you might still get infected and make other people very sick who aren't vaccinated. And so that's why, one, take the vaccine to protect yourself, and two, take the vaccine to protect other people. And I would relate it to HIV in a way. You know, people who have HIV, if they take their medication, they are virally suppressed and they live a long, normal, healthy life. And they cannot transmit HIV because the viral load is so low. But that's not the case with this particular virus. People will be okay, but they still can transmit it. So that's what people need to understand. This is a different virus than the previous one. It's stronger, it's more virulent, and so we have to take extra precautions to keep everybody safe.
All right, there are a couple things you said there that I want to pick up on. We've got a couple callers, though, that I want to grab. 1-800-423-8255. Let's first go to Patricia in Andover. Patricia, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm a school nurse in an elementary school. And my main focus and concern are for my elementary school students who have underlying health conditions. And I'm going to speak up for them because they need to be protected. And, you know, I mean, the kids have been the ones that have been the most cooperative wearing the mask. And, you know, we do have staff that are very vocal about they're not going to vaccinate. And they, you know, and they've given us hard times about wearing masks during the last 18 months. But my main thrust in my advocacy is for those vulnerable children in my building that have severe medical issues.
All right. Thank you for that, Patricia. I'm going to add a different voice then. We've got Alan on the line. Alan's up in New Hampshire. Alan, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks, Alan. Go right ahead.
Well, listen, I was kind of wondering a few things as I was listening to some of the other calls. And I remember we did talk a lot about herd immunity, and now we don't seem to have a goal as to when that will kind of show up. So I heard the president say he may actually try to institute a national mandate for everyone in the whole country to have the vaccine. And I wonder, now that millions of people have had it, 50% of the country is 150 million people, now that 150 million people or more have had the vaccine, why isn't it approved yet?
Okay. Thanks for that, Alan. I appreciate that. And actually, Alan, echoing there, the frustration we heard from Governor Baker during his press conference earlier today. Alan also brings up, though, an interesting sort of counterpoint to Patricia Jane that I want to go to, which is what can we and can't we and should we not mandate for other people? And as a former governor, I got to believe you've thought through how one thinks through those kinds of things. What's the thought process for a governor in sorting that out?
Well, first of all, vaccines for students attending schools has actually been a really hot legislative topic for some time because they are mandated, but there are loopholes that you can drive a truck through, as they say. We do not require proof of vaccination for adults. We have generally not done that. I think that we are going to probably have a ton of litigation that is going to prove what you can do. I think in general, these end up being federal issues because the virus doesn't recognize state borders, and there are a lot of trade and other issues that cross borders. So I think it's going to be decided at the federal level. I will say in general, where people have choice, of things that they can do. So I am scheduled to attend a conference next week. We just got notice that we must show proof of vaccination and a negative COVID test in order to be given our badge. I don't have to go to the conference. It's a privilege to go to the conference. I think in those cases, the legal standing is probably pretty strong that those people hosting the conference can make that. I think when we mandate that people go to school, that's where we get into trouble, and those issues will be worked out through the courts and the legislature.
So, Gary, I'm going to come back to you now, and I'm going to pick up on a thread from before those two calls where you talked about how and how this is and is not reminiscent of HIV/AIDS. And I am thinking about the outbreak specifically in Provincetown, which is a community that is so important to our gay community here in Massachusetts. The outbreak there, but also the efficacy of the contact tracing that has come from there. So I'm going to quote a little bit from Apoorva Mandavili, who writes today in the New York Times that an infectious disease specialist at Bellevue Hospital Center in New York noted of the P-Town response, quote, "This is one of the most impressive examples of citizen science I have seen. The people involved in the Provincetown outbreak were meticulous in making lists of their contacts and exposures," end quote. So how do you react to that?
Oh, I think it's I love Provincetown, first of all. I used to have a home there, and I have lots of friends there. And it has been remarkably impressive on two fronts. One, it's not a randomized control trial, but the fact that upwards of 95% of people had already been vaccinated gave us the ability to find out a lot about what's happening with people who are vaccinated. And I checked in with a friend of mine last week, and he had been contacted by the state and told that he had 11 contacts. He tested negative, thank goodness. But that just speaks to how willing people are there to make sure that they meticulously identify people that they may have come in contact with and make sure that those folks can get tested. So I think the fact that there are so many LGBTQ people there who've had the experience of HIV, you know, understand public health and understand what it means to make sure that your people who might potentially have come in contact with you need to know that they're at risk. Made a huge difference. And it has made a difference in the CDC's decision to make new guidelines, new recommendations. And so I'm really proud of my friends in Provincetown.
So I wonder then, Gary, oh, Jane, jump in. Go.
No, I was just going to say the other thing we haven't talked about yet is the other compelling data that is coming out of there is the life cycle of how long these shots, the vaccinations are good for. And I think the Provincetown case will give us really good insight into when or if we need a third booster shot, which is a whole nother public health issue that we're probably soon going to face.
So I want to, like 17 thoughts crashing in my head at once. So given the conversation we just had, Jane and Gary, are there opportunities for other messaging, other lessons, public health practices that we either could try for the first time or renew our call for or educate people for in a different way based on what we're learning from the Provincetown experience? Gary, maybe you first.
Well, I'm not sure yet. I mean, I think what's most important to me that people should know is this whole issue of people who became vaccinated, got COVID, didn't get very sick, but we now know that they can infect other folks. So I don't know whether that can help people understand, you know, the fact that the vaccine works and yet doesn't prevent this disease being transmitted altogether. I think that's part of why people are so confused, because they were under the impression that if you take a vaccine, you can do anything you want. And we have to kind of unmessage that a little bit. And that's the hard part, because people were so frustrated of having to wear masks and distance and not see their friends forever. You know, now they're traveling. I traveled last weekend and I was in Alabama. And I have to say, I saw as many people wearing masks as I do here, which is a good thing, except that they have a far lower vaccination rate than we do. So it's not as good. So I don't know whether, I think the messaging is the real issue. There are people who don't want to take the vaccine for various reasons, and we have to continue to educate people about the fact that the vaccine works and that it's safe. And until we can do that, I think people will still be a little bit hesitant. And there are some people who will always be hesitant. But
So Jane, thank you for that, Gary. Jane, host prerogative, I'm actually going to ask you a different question. Gary gave us a really satisfying answer there. And with the remaining time we have on this, I want to go back to schools, since that's an area that you focus on a lot, because a big part of the CDC's guidance is that all students, staff, and visitors to schools in the fall should be masked. But today, DESE and DPH, which are institutions here in Massachusetts, have issued updated guidance from Massachusetts that says no mandates, but they recommend districts allow vaccinated students and staff not to wear masks indoor this school year, and quote unquote strongly recommend that schools require masks for unvaccinated kids and staff. Therefore, also leaving it to local schools, I think, to make some of the decisions. Just overall, what's your reaction to that? You know, thumbs up, thumbs down, more confusing, less confusing?
Well, it might be a little more confusing, but it was completely consistent with the science and I think the right decision. What is right for Massachusetts schools? So the federal government and the CDC had to make a call based on what the state of affairs is for the entire country. And while the caller from New Hampshire talked about a 50% vaccination rate, those numbers, as Gary just talked about, Alabama to Massachusetts, vary widely. In Massachusetts, where we have among the highest rates in the country and where we know transmission to students is very low, then I think you can make a different statewide policy that is thoughtful, responsive to the science, allowing individual districts to veer because we know that there are a couple hot spots. And so allowing those districts to respond to different situations within their district, I think is how the science works. So it may be confusing, but it's consistent with science, which is, in my mind, this should be about science and not politics.
Still with us, former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift and Gary Daffin, Executive Director of the Multicultural AIDS Coalition. And we are shifting gears here. We're going to talk about a bunch of policies, starting with policing. And I want to talk about the release of the report on Patrick Rose yesterday. Does the release of the report from the city of Boston encourage you about police reform because it's out there? Or does it discourage you about police reform because it found that the police could and should have done more? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join the conversation. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Gary, reactions to the report's findings yesterday?
Well, I think it was important that they, you know, issued these findings. To me, what's more important is the broader recommendations of the police reform report that was sent out. And this is one of the recommendations, that they have more transparency about what policemen's activities. But I think because it's such a heinous crime, if you will, that it garners a lot of attention and maybe overshadows that there's a much broader picture here, a much bigger issue with the Boston Police Department and all police departments that we need to be focusing on, which is police reform overall. And I have to say, I think that the same sort of cancerous wall of silence that allowed this to happen is the same thing that allows policemen to get away with, you know, assaulting and killing Black and brown people around the country. Not that that has happened here, but, you know, it's the same problem that we've got to fix.
So, Jane, this question of transparency versus opacity is part of what's at the heart here. I want to play a little bit of sound of Acting Mayor Kim Janey talking about one of the recommendations that came out in the report.
To strengthen oversight, I will file an amendment to the OPAT ordinance requiring BPD to notify OPAT of criminal charges brought against officers.
Okay, so a lot of letters there. So let me just clarify. OPAT is the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency. It is new this year. It came from the police reform task force that the city of Boston did last year. And what she's saying is somebody would actually now need to know. Somebody with oversight responsibility would need to know if an officer has been charged with criminal charges. That is a technical response to this situation, and obviously one that the office feels is necessary. Will those kinds of technical responses also resolve the cultural issues of the kind that Gary was just talking about?
Well, I do think that often you can't unring a bell, right? So we can't change the terrible things that have happened in the past. But in general, when people know that their behavior is going to be brought out into the light, it tends to change behavior. And if it doesn't change behavior, then you can quickly cut the cancer out more quickly. So while it may be a technical response, those type of technical reforms can give good leaders, so that's the next part, good leaders the tools they need to change the culture.
So then, Gary, what else needs to happen?
Well, I think we really need to look at, how should we police our communities? And I know there's been a big debate about defund the police, which is not language that I would necessarily use, but I agree with the concept, which is we need to look at, you know, how do we figure out a way that community can really be involved with police and other services? Why are the police the only people that you can call at 2 o'clock in the morning if there's a problem? I know from my own work over the past 30 years, I often have staff people that would do a better job of going to deal with the situation than sending a policeman. On the other hand, we do have to, you know, obviously have police for certain situations. So I think we need to, you know, I think what has been called for rethinking how we set up police, rethinking how we train police and how we pay police, and that policemen and policewomen are required to have certain levels of education and training that's beyond what we currently require. I think those are all things that could make policing a much more attractive profession. My father was a policeman and a federal marshal, so I don't come to this with a extreme animosity towards policemen. I think there are plenty of fine policemen out there who want to do the right thing and who would also like to get rid of this particularly cancerous problem that we have.
So, Jane, what do you want to see happen next?
So, I think that first of all, I agree with Gary that I think the defund language actually doesn't serve anybody well. But I think of this, as you said, I do a lot of work in education, and oftentimes we've asked our teachers to solve every social ill in society. And in many ways, what I'm hearing Gary say is, you know, we get into trouble when we ask police to solve every social ill in society. And so I think this concept of making sure that we have more of the services that are necessary. And I think many people have thought about, you know, how do we have better and more appropriate mental health services for folks who get in trouble? I think one of the things coming out of this COVID crisis has been an escalation of an already terrible opioid crisis and drug crisis. So figuring out how we get the right services to the right people without asking a single professional like a police officer or a teacher to cure all of the ills within society perhaps could be the constructive conversation we have coming out of this moment.
All right. So since we are on the subject of law enforcement and reform, let's talk for a second about the nomination this week President Biden made of Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins as U.S. Attorney. If she is confirmed, she will be the first Black woman U.S. attorney in the Commonwealth. And certainly it seems reasonable to believe she will be known throughout the country as a real reformer, just as she is as DA. Gary, what are your reactions to the nomination? And what do you think she could do or should do or would do in a DA's seat? Excuse me, in a U.S. attorney's seat?
Well, I think the nomination is great. I think she's someone who's quite outspoken and has done a lot of good and shaken things up a bit. And I would expect her to continue to do that. I think, you know, I think her view of what I would call restorative justice will influence how she goes about doing her new job. and continuing some of the things that she's been doing, looking at, you know, how we charge people for low-level crimes, particularly drug crimes, looking at instances where people may have been convicted wrongly. Those are all things that, again, it connects to sort of the broader movement that we've been having in the country, the Black Lives Matter movement, but really a broader push to rethink our drug laws, rethink how we, our police reform, rethink how we do law enforcement in America. I think she'll be a good addition to the office.
So, Jane, there is a question mark there. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas says not so fast. Basically, he plans to try to block her nomination. The Boston Globe reports Cotton talking about the nation's problem with under-incarceration and that he feels she would advance the problem of under-incarceration. Does she get through, or are we watching somebody perhaps give up a seat and maybe not move on to the next thing? And what does that mean for the Commonwealth if that's what happens?
Well, I mean, technically, I would assume she'll do what most people do, which is not give up the seat until she's confirmed. But we'll see how it plays out. You know, I find it curious that there may be reasons for people to oppose the nomination and they have the ability to vote against it. But to block the nomination, particularly for this issue of under-incarceration, when both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, have actually come together, and one of the few things they've agreed upon is some criminal justice reform that has been centered around the fact that we probably over-incarcerate, is curious to me.
All right. So I do want to, for just a second, I want to bring up one other thing, and I'm going to play a little bit of sound for you guys here. This is Susan Ayani of Natick, one of the thousands of Trump supporters who stormed the Capitol building on January 6th. She is on this week on NPR talking to them about the day the police came to arrest her.
Luckily, I was dressed. I was having some coffee. So my husband answered the door, and I'm looking out, and I saw two black SUVs, a police car, and I said, oh, they're here. And they said, no laces. I'm like, okay, I hang myself over trespassing, you know.
So, Gary, one, that struck me because if the big black automobile showed up with law enforcement in front of my house, I think I would be very frightened, actually. And two, because this is a story that resonates deeply. Six arrests here in the area, and any other time, that would have been the story of the week this week, those hearings and the testimony there and the tie back here to the Commonwealth. Should we be paying attention to that here and how?
Well, I think we should be paying attention to it because people tend to think of Massachusetts as just this great liberal bastion and that everybody's super progressive. But, you know, we have a diversity of folks here, too. And as we know from some of the things that have been happening in the Republican Party, there are folks who are more aligned with the Trump supporters and the people who, you know, charge the Capitol. But I think if there's any instance of under-incarceration, it's under-incarceration of the people who attacked the Capitol and who tried to overthrow the government. So I think Senator Cotton's view, to me, says that he thinks there's too many of certain kinds of people who aren't in prison. There's a fundamental view that, you know, I think these people really didn't think that they would ever be held accountable. And because they felt that they were, quote, you know, defending the Constitution, which I don't think they really understand. But to me, it's also just a matter of, you know, people's sense of what it is to be American. I think that's a fundamental thing that we need to keep an eye on, what is happening in terms of, and it happens here in Massachusetts, not just across the country, what people see as how the country's changing and how that affects them. I see there's an underlying issue for this entire conversation about what's happening at the Capitol.
So, Jane, we've got just about one more minute to spend on this. I was also struck about her, what sounded like nonchalance towards the accusation of trespassing. And I want to ask you very briefly, what should the Republican Party response in the Commonwealth this week be to what we heard on Capitol Hill?
I actually think it should be an American response, not a partisan response. And I think that there's a great article in the Wall Street Journal by Peggy Noonan that I agree with wholeheartedly that outlines what that response should be, which is get to the bottom of it so it never happens again.
All right. On that, I do want to leave time now for our hubbubs, which are those brief local stories or events that caught our attention this week. And Jane, since I'm talking to you, how about you go first? Oh, Jane, did I lose you?
Oop, nope, sorry, I lost myself. I love the story in the Globe about the woman, Caitlin or Carlin Carr, a writer and editor who had cancer and chose to walk to and from Mass General with friends. And at the end of her article in the Globe, she said, well, I'll remember most about her journey with cancer is the long walks and long conversations. And I think this is a positive note, the lengths people will go to show up when you need them most.
Oh, thank you. Oh, I am amazed at the response I'm having to hearing such a good note. Okay, Gary, you.
First of all, that was a great story. I read it. Thank you, Governor, for sending it. I'm going to be going to We Sing Roxbury. It's a partnership between Friends of the Public Garden and the Boston Children's Chorus, and it's a summer series of community singing events in public parks in Boston, all ages and skill levels, people just singing and having games and prizes and socializing. Out in the open in the park, and this Sunday it's at We Sing Roxbury is at Clifford Playground in Roxbury, and you can just Google We Sing Roxbury and sign up and go have fun.
Fantastic. That also sounds joyous. Okay, so here's my hubbub. Yesterday, WBUR announced our new morning edition host, Rupa Shenoy. We invited her on yesterday afternoon to meet listeners, and we had some really serious technical challenges. It is a story that we are going to laugh about for years, but oh, that was tough. So I wanted to use my hubbub today to give it one more shot for her. We were able to catch Rupa for a minute just about an hour ago, and we had a chuckle over what happened.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, it's okay. No, it happens. But how are you today? Are you feeling ready to say hello anew to listeners on WBUR and Radio Boston?
I am. I'm so eager to say hi. And also, I learned something from yesterday. I mean, you really handle those live things that happen live really well. So
thank you. Yeah. Thank you. So the joys of live radio, right? We've got live listeners right now. What do you want to tell them?
I want to tell them that I'm really, really looking forward to being the person that helps them wake up every day and get ready for the day.
Fantastic. And have you started getting ready for how early you're going to have to get up for your own day? Because, man.
Yes, I am. I am doing it gradually. So I am currently at 4:40 a.m. I'm working my way like 5 minutes up every day. I've calculated with the month to go, I'm going to get there to and maybe 3:15.
And is there any caffeine enhancement involved, or are you just kind of going cold turkey?
If I could mainline tea, I would be. But since I can't, I don't have an IV drip, I'm actually just drinking tea constantly.
There you go. All right. So listen, we're going to have chances here to celebrate Bob Oakes, whose big shoes you're going to be filling. I know you will, too. But any shout outs you want to give him as you start this transition?
It's been so nice. He's been so welcoming and really has been so supportive. And I'm obviously coming in on the end of an incredible legacy and hoping to build on that, which is a lot of pressure and a lot of responsibility. And he's making that so much easier for me. And I'm so grateful.
I'm glad. Well, Rupa Shenoy, the new host, the incoming host of WBUR's Morning Edition, starting this fall, a big, warm hello and shout out to you.
Thank you so much.
So we are so excited here at Radio Boston to have Rupa join the WBUR team. So that is my hubbub, and that is our week in review. Former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, now the President and Executive Director of Learn Launch. Governor Swift, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And help me give a virtual high five, Jane, to Gary Daffin, the Executive Director of the Multicultural AIDS Coalition and the co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Gary, first time through. Well done. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
This week, we have been checking in on really what is truly a once-in-a-lifetime Olympic Games. This morning, I spoke with Boston Globe reporter John Powers from Tokyo about what he's seeing on the ground there and what we can expect in the remaining days of the competition.
Well, what's interesting is the sound of silence. As you know, the spectators are not allowed in any of the venues. So watching the women's all-around final in gymnastics, and it was like watching the podium training. There was almost no sound except for the coaches and teammates kind of cheering people on. And of course, the volunteers who are here, but you don't get that enormous, roof raising sound when someone lands a great trick.
Do you think that that lack of vibe and feedback from an audience affects the performances of the athletes?
It does. I think a lot of athletes derive a lot of energy from that, and they really get pumped up, especially in a team sport where you score a goal and the whole stadium goes crazy. It's funny, originally there was the feeling that the Japanese would benefit from not having any foreign spectators. Then they don't have any of their own spectators. So the home advantage that the Japanese normally would get, they don't have. That said, they have performed very well here. It's been an interesting games because it's been delayed a year. So you have an awful lot of situations where people who would not have been in these games last year are here now, and others who probably wanted to retire a year ago are here. So you are seeing people winning medals that you might not normally see.
You know, I know we don't have any local athletes in the gymnastics competition, but I also know it's part of the what America has been watching with bated breath, especially after Simone Biles choosing to withdraw from two different rounds of competition for mental health reasons. Key moments, highlights, surprises in watching the gymnastics this week?
Yeah, I think what was interesting is, obviously her teammates didn't know. I think they may have had a sense, but when she basically just walks off the floor and it's up on them, they were able to rally and still win a silver medal. And then Suni Lee, who was the number two gymnast, comes and wins the all-around, which was, that was extraordinary. It shows the depth of the U.S. team. And I think what you saw when they won the all-around was that the U.S. dynasty is still ongoing.
Is there a swimming dynasty, too? I know you're covering swimming as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's been a little more of the Americans are still winning medals, not a whole lot of golds. And I think we haven't quite figured out why that is happening. I think clearly the rest of the world is getting good. But, you look at a Katie Ledecky, who had never won anything but gold, suddenly gets a silver right off the bat, and then suddenly she is off the podium entirely. So I think what they're finding is that it's a much more competitive world, and other countries are also doing well. There's been a great games for the Chinese in the pool, the Japanese, Great Britain. So I think the day when the Americans own the pool pretty much is over, but they will still, I think, probably top the table there, but it's no longer a given.
So we're a week in, and I wonder, what is the scene, either inside the arena or outside of it, that you've witnessed this last week that most sort of plays behind your eyelids when you close your eyes at night?
Every game I've been to, there's an enormous buzz. There's an enormous feeling. You don't get that in the city here, and you don't get it inside. I mean, normally you go around a host city, and there are banners and murals and, slogans. You don't see that here. The Japanese people are not particularly enthralled about these games, or at least not bringing in 200-plus countries in the middle of a huge pandemic. So I think it's been downplayed, and you see that inside the arena, too. You walk in, and you almost have to make sure, I better pay attention, because I'm not going to hear any noise in this place. You really have to be, I'm much more focused than I would normally be.
And any competitive moments that have taken your breath away?
I think what was interesting is watching the U.S. women rally around in the middle of this thing. Because one thing that I think people may have heard, you only have four women on the team this year. It used to be seven. Now it's down to four. So when Simone Biles withdrew, every woman had to go up on every event with one hand slip, one fall, and they might not have won any medal at all. So that was what was really exciting. I think it made it because with Simone, they were probably going to win very easily. So I think that was the biggest suspenseful moment of these games so far. Could they hang in? And they did.
So here in the States, Biles has received just a lot of widespread support from athletes, fans. What about there? Have you been hearing about her decision from athletes there? And what's the reaction been like?
I think there is great sympathy. Certainly a lot of the athletes, and now especially, I think there is so much pressure, especially with the athletes are all over social media. Everyone knows them. They can be very critical on social media. So I think there was a feeling that they are applauding Simone for admitting that that is not easy. I mean, a lot of people think, who wouldn't want her life? She is rich, she's famous. And I think the level of expectations on her was just enormous. So I think there's a lot of empathy for her.
We have a lot of New England athletes there. I think we've all been watching and rooting for them. I know Rashida Ellis from Lynn, the boxer, had a disappointment this week.
Yeah.
Have you been watching any of the local athletes? And what can you tell us?
So far, it's been a disappointing games for them. We had two fencers that didn't do very well. The rowers were shut out for the first time in history. No U.S. rowers won medals. So pretty much what we're looking for now is in track and field with Gabby Thomas in the 200, El Puria St. Pierre in the 1500. There are possibilities there. As you say, there was a surprising loss by Rashida Ellis. She went out in her first bout. So I think things are now kind of shifting to what's ahead. Fewer athletes will be competing. But I think the ones that will have very good medal chances.
What are you going to take away from this?
Well, I think it's funny. A lot of people are looking forward to Paris in 2024. I feel badly for the Japanese organizers. This is not something that they had prepared for. We are trying to consider or at least get some joy out of these games because always that's what they're about. And it's very hard when the emperor opens the games and is reluctant to use the word celebrating, which is part of what he's supposed to say. These are really kind of a downplayed games. I've never been to one that's been like that. So we're looking forward to, ideally, a different and better world in 2024 in Paris.
First thing you're going to do when you get out of your required 14-day quarantine there?
I am going to have a glass of wine. I'm just looking forward to getting out into the city and seeing the actual Japanese people. Who've been very gracious. So the people that we've dealt with, the volunteers have been wonderful.
So I will have a glass of wine in your honor tonight.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
John Powers, reporter for the Boston Globe. John, enjoy the remainder of your time and that glass of wine when you get it.
Thanks so much. Sayonara.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. We had help from Ali Audette. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Hey, join us on Monday. We will have Jotham Busfield and John Cuna, both licensed therapists and co-hosts of the Grim Drive podcast, which uses sports as a way to talk about mental health. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about mental health now in the world of sports. So join us then. In the meantime, have a great weekend. You've been listening to Radio Boston.